It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the UW's Dictionary of American Regional English interviewed people around the country in the 1960s to map the diversity of our language. Now they're going digital. We'll find out how the conversations serve as an unintentional time capsule.
First, today marked the opening of the four-day United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York. It also marked President Trump's first appearance before a body that he heavily criticized on the campaign trail.
In a special session today, Trump said, quote, bureaucracy and mismanagement, end quote, were preventing the organization from reaching its full potential. Tomorrow, the president will address the entire General Assembly, which is composed of 193 nations. Some have called this the Super Bowl of diplomacy.
Nahal Tusi is foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of how significant this speech is for a new president?
Well, it's a very important moment for him. This is his first truly global audience that he's going to meet face-to-face. And these aren't just any people. These are the leaders of dozens of countries across the world. So the message that he gives them can have a lot of impact in terms of their thinking about him. And from what we're hearing, he's going to really kind of challenge the United Nations and the world community to work together in a way that is, more respectful of national sovereignty and more in terms of burden sharing, lead other countries to step up and do more of their part than just leaving a lot of things to the United States.
Now, President Trump, over the years, has had various stances on the United Nations as a real estate developer. In that role, he's been more positive. Lately, on the campaign trail, he's certainly been more critical. What's expected of him going in? Are tensions running high for this?
It's a very widely anticipated speech, but I wouldn't say that there's a lot of tensions running high. Of course, I suppose if you're the North Korean delegation, you might be a little bit tense. And if you're the Iranian delegation, you might be a little bit tense. But generally speaking, I think people are going to expect Trump to offer a mixed message. On the one hand, saying, like he has very recently, saying that the UN has great potential. But on the other hand, saying, look, various countries have their own sovereignty, and we need to respect that. And more countries need to step up and not just simply rely on the U.S. to lead everything. And also just the issue of UN reform, which is just that the UN is kind of this, like, bizarre, Byzantine organization whose lines of authority basically look like a spaghetti bowl. And he's just going to call on them to reform that and make things more streamlined, more efficient, less bureaucratic, and certainly less corrupt. And frankly, that's something that he's going to have wide support for across the UN and the world.
Now, the president spoke to a limited group today. What did he say?
Today the event was about UN reform, and he hosted it, and he said that he thinks the UN has a lot of potential. And that's kind of a message a lot of people do want to hear. They were a little bit worried that he might basically say, look, it's useless, why are we doing this? He came in and said there is potential for this organization to function better, to be more effective, to have a role to play. And that really, it's interesting because it dovetails with what the UN Secretary General wants to do. He really wants to reform the United Nations. At the same time, it's a really great political message for Trump because his domestic base, which is somewhat nationalist leaning and skeptical of organizations like the UN, he can tell them, hey, look, I pushed the UN to reform. I pushed it to get better. And so that kind of works for him both ways.
There seems to be a contrast between the attitudes of former President Barack Obama and the new president, Donald Trump. What has that done to set up the difference in expectations and how the new UN, if it takes Donald Trump up on some of his suggestions, might function?
Well, I would argue that, the Trump administration is much more forceful about what it wants. I mean, Obama also wanted UN reform, but he just wasn't pushing the issue as much. But I would also say that Obama, like a lot of people, liked him because they felt like they could predict him. They felt like he was an internationalist, a globalist, that he understood them, that he believed in the value of alliances and multilateral organizations and international negotiations, not simply bilateral ones. Whereas with Trump, the one thing people will simply say is, we just don't know what he's going to do. He's mercurial. He's unpredictable. So, when people say, what's he going to say tomorrow during his speech, we always have to give a caveat of, look, it's Trump. He might just go off script. He might say something we cannot predict whatsoever. So that's the one thing that really rattles people overseas, is that they don't know what he's going to do. And that worries adversaries, probably, but it also worries U.S. allies.
We're talking with Nahal Tusi right now, political foreign affairs correspondent, and she's joining us to look at President Trump's first major speech to the United Nations, which is coming up tomorrow, and looking at issues, a simple issue of funding, of solvency for the UN. Where does that stand, or where is it likely to stand under President Trump?
You mean in terms of his support for funding? Well, no. Part of what Trump has done is propose serious budget cuts to foreign aid that the U.S. disperses, and that includes cuts to the U.N. budget. Now, the U.S. offers 22% of the U.N.'s core biennial budget. That's a lot, far larger than any other group, and Trump and others want to reduce that. Now, whether Congress goes along with it, so far the Senate has not shown any indication it's going to go along with the budget cuts that Trump is proposing, but simply the mere threat of cutting the U.N.'s budget has led people at the U.N. to think, you know what, maybe we need to shape up a little bit. And so when it comes to U.N. peacekeeping, for example, they have agreed to $500 million in cuts. It's not as much as Nikki Haley, our U.N. ambassador, wanted or what Trump wanted, but it's still a lot more than many people thought that we would have gotten.
Now, early on, when President Trump was still campaigning, when he was a candidate, there was disagreement in the approach that the UN was taking with China. Is there an update on that? And has he made any recent remarks on that?
With China? Well, you know, when it comes to China, President Trump really sees his lens on China is largely about trade. He has, for years, felt like China has been snookering the U.S. on trade and basically like just policing the U.S. And he's learning, however, that when it comes to the United Nations, he needs China on a number of issues, especially North Korea and how to deal with North Korea. So on the one hand, he wants to go after China on in international forums that deal with trade. On the other hand, he wants to keep their good graces to help reduce the threat from North Korea. And this is just one of those real challenges. It's a question of what is more important, what's going to have a longer term effect, and you know, to some degree, they're trying to play both sides. And the Trump administration is going after China on some fronts on trade, but probably not as hard as they would be going were it not for the North Korea issue.
Now, the North Korea issue is one that is present and is ongoing. Is the president expected to make any remarks about that, or stick to the generalities about the UN and how it functions?
He's definitely going to be talking about North Korea tomorrow, really calling them out. And in all likelihood, he will call out China for not doing enough and possibly even call out Russia, which some people are reporting has been not that helpful on the North Korea issue. So I do definitely expect President Trump to discuss the North Korean nuclear threat during his speech tomorrow, and in probably some pretty tough terms. Of course, you know, we've also noticed is that whenever President Trump says something really tough, like North Korea is going to be met with fire and fury or whatever, the North Koreans don't necessarily react to that the way he might like. They just keep testing missiles and nuclear weapons, and it just keeps escalating things. So this is the question. Is he going to keep escalating it, or is he going to look for a way to calm things down?
Now, you said that it could be that allies overseas would be a little more tense in the fact that they might not know what the president is going to say. Is there a list of expectations for allies and others who are looking for him to say particular things tomorrow?
Well, I think a lot of them want to hear that he does believe in the value of multilateral organizations like the United Nations. They are worried about this idea of America first, the slogan that Mr. Trump has bandied about, and they are hoping that at the very least he will assure them, look, America first does not mean America alone. But it's all about the tone. It's all about the exact wording. But I will also say this. It's not just about what he says. It's also about what his administration does. A lot of times Trump's rhetoric is much further ahead than his administration's actual actions. And the other thing I should add is a lot of people are also wondering what Trump will tweet before and after his speech, and whether that could possibly undercut any of the goodwill that he might gain through the speech.
Nahal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Nahal Tusi, Politico foreign affairs correspondent, joining us to look at President Trump's first major speech to the United Nations, which is coming up tomorrow. And you can join us tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time when we'll have more in-depth coverage of the president's upcoming remarks.
Right now, the University of Wisconsin's Dictionary of American Regional English has been mapping the richness and diversity of language for over 50 years. And between 1965 and 1970, field workers traveled the country recording interviews with hundreds of people from Hawaii to New England. And those recordings are now available online.
Besides uncovering colorful phrases and unique pronunciations, the conversations also give us a fascinating window to the past. People shared stories about their upbringing, their work life, race relations, and more.
Joan Houston Hall is the chief editor emerita of the Dictionary of American Regional English. She joins us now in the studio. Joan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us the origin of these interviews. What were these field workers out there collecting and why?
They were collecting primarily vocabulary based on a huge questionnaire, more than 1,600 questions, about what people call the things in their daily lives. What do you call words for time or weather or food or clothing or money or religion or health and disease? All parts of our lives. And we collected 2.5 million or so responses. But at the same time, these people were asked if they would be recorded. And this was pretty new for some people. A few declined because they were a little suspicious. They've never done it before. But we ended up with 1,843 recordings from all over the country.
And they're becoming available now. Why now?
Well, over the years, we've had many versions of these tapes. We had to preserve them a couple of times to keep them viable. But about 15 years ago, we digitized them, and we wanted to make them available. But we had told these people that their names would not be released and that the recordings would be used for scholarly purposes. So over this time, we had allowed scholars to use them as long as they agreed to keep the names confidential, not to broadcast them, not to transcribe them, that kind of thing. But we knew that there was such a wealth of material here, we wanted to make them available. So we decided that we would go to each recording and, using a program called Audacity, put a little bleep anytime a particular personal name or a bit of sensitive information was on the tape. So using graduate students, undergraduate students, and volunteers, as well as interns, we were able over about 4 years to go through all of these and bleep out the sensitive information.
You said 1,400 some recordings. Did I get that right?
1,843.
And they're all somewhat lengthy, I would imagine. So this was a huge task. I mean, you had to listen to every second of these to find the names and bleep them out.
That's right. Some interviews were fairly short, maybe 15 minutes or so, but others went on for 8 reels of tape.
Wow.
And students had to be trained in order to know what to bleep. We finally ended up with some policies saying that if a particular name could be found on Google and was a generally recognized name, that was something we didn't need to bleep. But for the informants themselves and the field workers, we kept that private.
Now, this was intended to be, and has been part of the study of regionalism and language, but did the field workers ever have any sense that they were getting was more than that, that it was going to be something of historical record and a document of people's day-to-day lives?
I suspect that they did, and as it turned out, it's a wonderful snapshot of mid-20th century culture. We had the people do two things. One was to read a silly little story called Arthur the Rat that was designed to have all of the sounds in American English that would vary from one place to another. So in the name, for instance, Arthur the Rat, some people say Arthur, some people say Arthur, some author. And because the same story was read all across the country, we have a magnificent database of the same thing spoken differently in every community.
And you mentioned Arthur the Rat or Arthur the Rat. We have a couple pieces of audio from this collection. I want to give a listen to one from 1970. It's a recording of a 68-year-old African-American woman from Bridgeport, Connecticut, who I guess found the story of Arthur the Rat a little upsetting.
It seemed odd to them that the building was not haunted by rats. At last, one of them happened to move aboard and caught the sight of young... Yeah. I can't speak the rest of it.
Sorry.
I can't stand speaking about rodents of any kind. It gives me the creeps.
And it's, I mean, this gives you, that's just one little example, but a little sign of a personality of the people involved in this huge project.
Yes, it came out some in the Arthur the Rat clips, but the field workers also were tasked with just talking to these mm-hmm. people about anything that interested them. So we have conversations about family and community and jobs and politics and dreams and anything you can imagine. And they're all searchable through the database in the Digital Collection Center.
Well, let's take a listen to another recording. This one is from 1968, and this is an 80-year-old man from Anago, Wisconsin, talking about a job that his father got for him at a logging camp.
So he got the job for me, unbeknown. He didn't consult me, but I know when school is about over, he said, "Well, I got a good job for you." And I said, "Well, what is it?" "Well, you're going to be work with a bunch of real old tigs, old tig lumberjacks. And I think it'll be good for you, and I think you'll enjoy it. You've been around with me, and you know a little about them, and I know that it'll be an experience, and it won't be an easy one by any means." Well, what could I say? I couldn't say I'm not going to take it. I just, that wasn't done in our family. I accepted it.
Super interesting listening to that. I was trying to think, can I tell that this is someone from Wisconsin? I don't know if I can, and I also don't know what tig means. I hear a lot. What do you hear in this one?
Well, I don't know what tig means either. But I was thinking that most of our listeners probably think that this speech sounds kind of normal. Mm-hmm. But if they contrast it with the woman from Connecticut, I'm sure they'll see great differences. Vowels, for instance, in the Antigo man, he talks about logs, where other people might say log or lag. And the woman in Connecticut had some vowels that were certainly not heard in the Antigo man. So sometimes you have to listen very carefully to see differences. But even in the tapes from people from different parts of Wisconsin, there are some very distinct differences.
We're talking to Joan Houston Hall, Chief Editor Emerita of the Dictionary of American Regional English, talking about interviews recorded in the 1960s, now available, many of them online for you to check out. And Joan, what did scholars do with these interviews? You were mentioning the vowel differences there, for example. How did they compare and contrast these different speakers from around the country to try to figure out who said what where?
Well, early in the use of these tapes back in the 70s, say, they simply had to listen and transcribe by hand. Now, of course, you can do it digitally and get much more sophisticated results. But scholars made studies of the vowels in different communities, different pronunciations of consonants. They would analyze conversation patterns, and other people used them too, in particular actors and dialect coaches. Mm. So if they were doing a play set in southern Alabama, they could write to us and say, "What do you have of a middle-aged man from this community in Alabama?" And very often we could provide a really good sample for them.
I'm curious about how the field workers found these people. It seems like so many people, and I think I also heard you say they had to answer something like 1,600 questions. Why were people willing to do that?
Well, it was amazing. The field workers went cold into communities and were told only that they had to find people who had lived there all their lives, and they were to emphasize older people because they wanted to collect words and phrases that were going out of use. But they also found younger people as well. And so we could compare the speech of older and middle-aged and younger people. But it was often very difficult to find people. And sometimes the field workers decided that the first thing they should do was check in at the police station. And one reason for that was that this was civil rights demonstration era, And they were in the South, many of them, with word wagons emblazoned with the University of Wisconsin on the side. Mm. And that was a red flag for some people. So they had to establish their bona fides before trying to find people. But if they could say, oh, Sheriff Jones suggested you might be able to help me, then that was a really good entree into the community.
You mentioned, you know, this is in the 1960s, talking to older people, but even in this day and age, these variations in the way we say words around the country, they haven't gone away, have they?
They haven't. People like to think that our language has become homogenized, but it's certainly not true. And in fact, there are new distinctions that are being heard all the time. So it's a project that could go on forever.
It's a fascinating project, and it sounds to me like the stories from some of these field workers are also going to stay with them alongside the scholarly impact. There was a fellow who did this as a field worker in his 20s, remembers being taken in and going raccoon hunting with the family that he was working with.
Yes, he was one of our best field workers, August Rubrecht, who's in Eau Claire now, and he has wonderful stories. Fortunately, he kept a journal of his experiences, so he's been able to write about his experiences in the DARE newsletter. So if you go to the DARE website, www.dare.wisc.edu, you can see the newsletters, you can hear audio clips, you can go to our collection and learn a great deal about this project.
Well, Joan, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Joan Houston Hall, Chief Editor Emerita of the Dictionary of American Regional English, talking with us about how field interviews done for that project in the 1960s are now available online.
LaCroix Sparkling Water got its start more than 30 years ago in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and sales have been rising in recent years.
While LaCroix is popular and a hometown favorite and beloved by its fans, probably, it is not alone. Seltzer sales are growing quickly, increasing 42% over the last 5 years, according to the research and consulting firm Beverage Marketing Corp.
But what's in it? That's a big question, according to Bob Copeland. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the piece LaCroix Fizzy Water. Water is everyone's favorite. Nobody knows what's in it. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
So, Rob, LaCroix lists on the can the word essence as an ingredient. First, what does the company say essence is?
Well, it's pretty ridiculous, right? LaCroix is the hottest, trendiest thing here. I live in New York and Brooklyn. It's piled to the ceiling in supermarkets. It's a pretty new thing for us, though. I know in Wisconsin, you guys were way ahead of the game. And they say it's flavored by something called essence. They say it's not simply, it's not sugar, it's not artificial, it's natural essence. And I asked the company, what is natural essence? And they gave me some pretty out there answers. They said it's feelings and it's aroma and it's sensory effects. And that's not something that you usually associate with your sparkling water.
So essence is feelings by one account.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And I went back and I said, listen, it's a very popular product. I don't think that there's anything evil in here. Can you just tell us what you're putting in there? And they really didn't want to.
It is sort of the magic ingredient. You spoke to some people who said, well, it's sort of an aftertaste and a hint of a flavor at the same time. But it's also interesting that people don't seem to really care what essence is.
It's completely incredible. They have a very hard time expressing what it is they actually like about LaCroix. And many of these people are drinking up to a dozen a day, and they're very passionate about judging other people who drink other seltzers. But when it comes down to it, their description of what essence is, you know, it's a kind of like a fruit, but it's not a fruit, and you can tell it involves fruit, but maybe it doesn't involve fruit. And then in the end, most of them just say, I don't care.
Yeah, well, so if it were an ingredient that we knew what it was, I suppose it could be subject to regulation somehow. But what do you do when it's sort of more of an idea than an ingredient?
Well, the FDA really gives you a lot of runway to say whatever you like about your products. So they don't even define what essence is, and their rules on using the word natural are pretty nebulous. They They would argue, though, that this is always evolving and that, of course, that it has to be safe. And certainly LaCroix can point and say that people have been drinking it for 30 years and there's been no outbreaks from LaCroix.
Now, moving on, because we're not going to get to the bottom of this, what Essence is in this interview, that's for sure. You weren't able to do it, and the company is keeping, you know, keeping kind of a close lid on what Essence is. But we do know that sparkling water is seeing a big surge lately. Why is that?
Well, I would just say one thing is that we do know what Essence is, and the answer is that it's not anything particularly special. It's actually been around for 100 years, and it's essentially what you do is you mash up the leftover bits of fruit, you heat it up, you capture the steam, you condense it, and you get a super highly concentrated chemical. It's the same thing that's in bug spray. If you know, when you shoot out bug spray, you kind of can sort of smell something weird, but it's not quite a smell. That's Essence.
Wow, I'm trying to absorb that. Is that something that's used widely across the food industry?
It is. It's pretty incredible, actually. Some of your listeners might remember about 2 decades ago, Welch's grape jelly had an ad, and the ad sort of showed them heating up grapes, and they'd go through these tubes above the grapes, and then they put out this flavoring. That's actually just Essence.
Hmm. And so if it's used in other food products, I mean, why not just put, in that instance, grapes on the label? Why Essence?
Well, I think that's the billion-dollar question, right? Sparkling water is super popular right now. Everyone has their own brand. A lot of stores are coming out with house brands that are, you know, in some cases a third of the price of LaCroix. If you just said, hey, this is the same stuff that's in everything else, people might not be willing to pay you the premium for it.
And looking at the sparkling water industry again, LaCroix is a front runner, but there are others. Well, what's going on in the industry that's making it so hot right now?
Well, it's super interesting, right? Because bottled water was very popular maybe 10, 15 years ago. Certainly, it's still popular. But the Poland Springs and the Dasani's have sort of plateaued. The real growth is coming in sparkling. And all of LaCroix's competitors are taking a look at this company, which whose stock price has more than doubled in the past year. And they're saying, we have Essence, too.
We're talking.
So now everyone's in this game.
Rob Copeland is with us right now, reporter with the Wall Street Journal, and he joined us to explore the popularity of LaCroix and other sparkling waters. They're seeing a spike in popularity right now. And Rob, you're saying Essence is not necessarily proprietary. It doesn't belong to one company. Did you find out whether there's any sort of limit about one can make Essence of? Can you make Essence of anything?
You can make Essence of pretty much any organic material, and in fact, you can make Essence that doesn't taste very good at all. The best explanation of what Essence is, if you just picture when you're making tomato sauce from scratch and your whole home sort of smells that wonderful smell of tomatoes, the smell is the essence of tomato. So if you could capture that and you could turn it into a chemical, that's essentially it.
So is an essence, I mean, to simplify it, is it basically just a smell?
That's what LaCroix says. It's an aroma. It's not a smell in the sense that it in the end is a liquid. So in the end, you can taste it. But yes, it should have some of the qualities of smell. And certainly the people who've been drinking LaCroix for 30 years will say that they kind of like that it's just a hint, that it's not it doesn't, you know, hit you over the head.
Well, if you look at, for instance, tea, some teas are billed for the flavor in the mouth, and some are more about the fragrance. And the way that we take in flavors is a lot of it's through the nose. So in that sense, it seems as though the smell must be a big part of it, even though we perceive it in the mouth, too.
Exactly. You're 100% right. And I like your pun there, that you inadvertently, in essence, that's the... I spent the last 3 months making that exact same joke.
Hopefully yours were on purpose.
Sure.
So have you tried all the various essences out there? Does one stand out to you with these various flavored waters that we have?
Well, it's interesting. I did a bit of a taste test here, and I really cannot tell the difference between LaCroix and Polar and SodaStream and a lot of these. When you close your eyes, they really taste very, very similar. But if you speak to the enthusiasts, they just will only drink LaCroix. And, you know, LaCroix used to be served in the 80s on United Airlines. It was nobody wanted it. You know, no, there's nothing cool that's happening on United Airlines, let's be honest. And it's just amazing how it has turned from something so common to something so trendy.
Well, speaking of things that are trendy, usually when that thing rises to popular notice, someone tries to bump it up to the next level. Is there a next level for Essence?
You know, there probably is. Just last week, LaCroix came out with their latest flavor. It's key lime. So they already have lime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like
they
the lime.
They think that that's not special enough. So now they have LaCroix key lime. And all indications are that people are excited to try it. So they can really keep bumping it out. They have a cola essence product.
Cola
so
essence.
They say it's not soda, it's cola essence.
So that gets on board, you know, people saying you got to stop drinking soda and the high fructose corn syrup in it might not be good for us. This is the solution. You get essence of cola, maybe, or at least a solution for some people.
Exactly. You know, a lot of people have been asking me, is this stuff healthy at the end of the day? And I think probably the healthiest thing you can do is drink plain water from your own tap in most parts of this country. But if your choice is, should I drink a diet soda or should I drink a LaCroix, which has this essence, or another sparkling water? There's no doubt that the sparkling water, you're getting closer to a healthier choice.
You said the essence was the same thing, though, in bug sprays. So I don't know, is there any cause for concern there? I don't think of bug sprays as being particularly natural or healthy.
No, true. There's a lot of natural ingredients that are very dangerous for you. You know, you can make cyanide in a way that is, quote, natural. It's a true fact that that's natural, but obviously you shouldn't be consuming that. But the key is that with anything that says that it has natural flavors is just to understand that that doesn't mean that it only has one thing in it. The FDA will allow you to put trace amounts of dozens up to, say, around 50 different ingredients in something and just call it natural flavors. So if you really don't want to have anything that has an additive, you're stuck with tap water, really.
And Rob, you did a deep dive on this essence thing. Is there an essence that you would like to see, a flavor in your, if you could wave your magic wand, that you would create?
I mean, I would definitely love Coke to bring back the regular Coke Zero, but that's not the question you asked. Look, I think it's exciting. It's fun to try that. They have 21 different flavors now. My favorite is the apricot, and I can tell you, I can't stand apricot in real life.
Hmm.
So there is something to it, because I will drink LaCroix apricot, like it's water.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Rob Copeland, reporter with the Wall Street Journal, joining us to look at the popularity of essences and LaCroix and other sparkling waters. They're having a moment right now.
First, it was a big night for TV fans yesterday when Hollywood hosted the 2017 Emmy Awards. Shows like The Handmaid's Tale and Big Little Lies were the stars of the ceremony, each taking home several awards.
The night had some obvious political overtones, too. Sean Spicer showed up, celebrities criticized the president, and political satirist Stephen Colbert hosted the event. Here's Colbert poking fun at the president about Celebrity Apprentice.
We know that the biggest TV star of the last year is Donald Trump. And we all know the Emmys mean a lot to Donald Trump because he was nominated multiple times for Celebrity Apprentice, but he never won. I tell you this, if he had won an Emmy, I bet he wouldn't have run for president. The president has complained repeatedly that the Emmys are rigged. He even went after the host a few years back, tweeting that Seth Meyers is hosting the Emmy Awards is a total joke. He is very awkward with almost no talent. Marbles in his mouth.
We want your thoughts on the Emmys, the shows that won, and the shows that you watch, which may not be the same thing. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you watch award shows, why or why not. What do you think the biggest takeaways from this year's ceremony are? And what is your favorite TV show, whether it won or lost, whether it was nominated or not? What do you watch and how do you watch it? Do you watch in real time on broadcast? Do you stream? Tell us about how you watch TV and what you watch at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Interesting to see Handmaid's Tale go home with some big awards last night. And that's a stream program. So we're really seeing the landscape changing for I guess, television content. Do we still call it television content? I don't know. But it also hit home to me last night that I got to catch up on my TV.
Yeah, there's so much out there. I mean, it's like books now. There are so many things, and they're so long because they run for seasons. There's this long mental list I have of shows that I am never, literally, by the laws of physics, never going to see them all.
What's at the top of your list?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I'd like to see Handmaid's Tale. Atlanta is supposed to be really funny.
Atlanta, yes, I want to see that.
That is one I want to watch. But there's like shows that aren't on the air anymore. Like, oh, I've seen some Key and Peele skits. Those are really funny. I'd like to watch those. That's been and gone already, and I haven't even watched it. So, yeah, mm-hmm. there is no hope for me.
This is true. That's our conclusion today.
That's it.
All right, let's
slogan.
Go to a caller now. We have Nikki joining us in East Troy. Nikki, hello.
Hi, thanks for having my comment on air.
Sure.
It was just a very interesting night for the minority. I would say women are considered a minority, and so are African-American. There were two awards that were given out for first African-American woman and African-American male to win those awards, and I was just really happy and very surprised that this was the first time. It took 2017 to happen, but it's better late than never. And then as many awards that women have been winning for writing, producing, acting, it was just a really good show for once to actually watch the awards.
Nikki, thank you so much. Yeah, appreciate that. And thank you for bringing that up. I saw a hashtag Emmy so diverse. I don't know if it was a real hashtag or just used in the piece I was reading. But a lot of people, certainly on Twitter, echoing exactly Nikki's sentiments there. And also a surprise at seeing, you know, we have to get to 2017 to see, for example, an African-American male winning an award, African-American writer, director.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Nikki, at 800-642-1234. Looking for your calls. The Emmys were last night. Want to hear your thoughts on the ceremony, the shows that won, and the shows you watched. Saw an article in Variety, at least a survey, looking at the nominated shows. A lot of people haven't watched them. Some of them hadn't heard of a lot of the shows that were nominated, and that speaks to there are just so many different shows and ways to mm-hmm. watch them out there. Love to know about your TV viewing habits or computer streaming habits at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Some serious moments at last night's Emmys. Here's Nicole Kidman on the TV now. Think of her as a movie actress. She accepted an award for Big Little Lies, a show on which she plays a woman who's in an abusive marriage.
Sometimes when you're acting, you get a chance to bring a bigger message. And this is their contribution and your contribution. We shone a light on domestic abuse. It is a complicated, insidious disease. It exists far more than we allow ourselves to know. It is filled with shame and secrecy. And by you acknowledging me with this award, it shines a light on it even more.
Nicole Kidman talking about the show Big Little Lies. She accepted an award for the show on last night's Emmy Awards. Looking for your Emmy favorites, ones that you think should be winning awards that aren't, the shows that are appointment viewing for you, whether you watch them when they go out on a broadcast signal or you binge watch them the moment they appear on one of many streaming services now. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And one of our colleagues thought that one actor deserved more recognition than he got. That colleague, by the way, is Dean Klenner, who's sitting across the board from us here running things for us. And Dean, you said, I haven't watched a lot of TV in the past year, but I thought David Harbour was fantastic in Stranger Things. He didn't win for supporting actor in a drama, a strange thing in itself. That's from Dean Knetter.
Oh, yeah, add that one to the list of shows that I really ought to be watching and have not yet. There's just so much out there. Plus, the kids hog the TV. So
it's not fair with the kids.
But, you know, better than me, I guess.
Well, you can call up and give us your suggestions. What hidden gems have you discovered? What did you try that you didn't think you'd like and you got hooked on? What about the Nicole Kidman show, Big Little Lies, that we just heard about that also involves Reese Witherspoon? It's supposed to be fantastic. I remember reading about it maybe several months ago, and I thought, I got to watch that. Well, I did not watch it. But we have talked about on this show about how we seem to be in a golden age of television. Mm-hmm. You get the intricacy, and you get the chance to spin out a plot line over seasons. And I think that's also, it ties people up in a single show more than, you know, a movie might have.
Definitely. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Not hearing from a lot of you with your favorite TV shows. Often when we talk about shows, we do get a lot of public radio fans, are, have you turned against the TV now or in the past? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We heard from one of our producers, Jay Carlisle Larson, who said, I'm a forever a tried and true Parks and Recreation fan. Always felt that Amy Poehler was snubbed every year when she lost in the Best Actress category to Julia Louis-Dreyfus of Veep. She won again, by the way. Mm-hmm. But she says after starting Veep last year, she gets it now. She gets why Dreyfus wins every time she's nominated as an ensemble show. It's hilarious. Oh, yeah. My wife watched Veep. That one I haven't. Do I ever watch TV? I feel like I do.
Maybe you don't watch TV.
I wish I hadn't watched. I watched more of the Packer game last night than the Emmys, and maybe I made the wrong strategic choice. That didn't turn out great. 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And Game of Thrones not in a contender this year, which some people said made room for other people who deserved recognition, other shows that deserved recognition. So it'll be interesting to see what it's like when Game of Thrones is back on the list again, because that was definitely a talked about TV show this year.
Right. When I first saw the nomination list, I was like, how did Game of Thrones not get any? Because it's always, well, it's because it didn't air at the right time. It mm-hmm. wasn't part of this schedule now.
And Rob, you're a huge Game of Thrones fan. Have you been keeping up?
No, as I've said, we're going to get some insight into the nerdiness of Rob here. I've watched a few seasons. I'm sticking with the books now. And maybe, fingers crossed, after all the books come out and I read the books, then I might go back and watch. But basically, you have two different storylines going now. And
how could you
I'm
keep
sticking
it
with the books.
In
exactly.
Your head otherwise. That's it,
'cause here, this character's there. Here, they're doing this different thing. Here, they have a different name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out.
Which begs the question, does George R.R. Martin still have any idea where to track in the book that we hope he's writing right now? What if he gets confused and writes the wrong book?
I want to bring in another caller now. Kim is with us from Waupun. Kim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I did watch some of the Emmys. I don't watch it all the time because a lot of the shows I don't get to see, mm-hmm. like Orange is the New Black, never seen it. I am interested in seeing the one with the hood. I'm sorry, I forgot the name of the show. But I felt that
Handmaid's
Big Little Lies.
The one with the hood, I got you.
but you said Big Little Lies was good.
Yes, I watched that, and all the ladies did a wonderful job. And I felt that they really did deserve the Emmys. I really like the show. So if you haven't seen it, please watch it. It is very telling and very compelling how they tell the story.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your love for Big Little Lies. I don't know. Our lists are long already. That was one coming in I didn't really know much about, except for Nicole Kidman was in it.
Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon.
Right.
And she's behind. She's the creative force behind that one. So that's definitely one that I'm going to catch up on, I think.
Well, you can check out more information, find out who won the Emmys if you missed it, and share your favorites. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. The U.S. Social Security Administration released its list of the top baby names in every state for 2016. My kids are already named, so I didn't need to look at this for inspiration. Maybe you are. Maybe you're looking for inspiration. What do we got?
Well, so taking a look state by state, we're going to start with Wisconsin here. The top baby names in Wisconsin are Oliver for boys and Olivia for girls.
So Oliver and Olivia. So basically... the same name for boys and girls.
Well,
Oliver,
we're consistent
Olivia.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah, no Olive, though. I mean,
this
you could
is
go...
true. This is true. We like our a couple extra vowels.
Right. So we're consistent. And Henry was a close second in Wisconsin for boys. Emma was second for girls.
Other trends, Rob, Robert, and Veronica showed up in the top 0%.
Yeah, they were not in the top 5 anyway. But I think, I don't know, I think here in Wisconsin, there's going to be a big trend of not naming kids after us. Or maybe, you know, let us know, actually, if you... I'm not going to count on anybody naming kids after us. What else stood out to you in the top names list around the country?
Right. Well, Harper as a girl's name on the list. Mason is still popular. Ava, Noah, Elijah, and lots of Williams and Liams.
Yeah, Williams
in states
and
the
Liams
country.
Were all over the place. Well, check out that news. We'll pop it up on the Central Time Facebook page later today and let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR what baby name is hot in your household. This is Central Time.